Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen talk radio show. My guest for this morning is Joseph Linovit. Joseph began writing at 16 and has won a number of literary awards even before publishing his first book. Joseph and I will be discussing about his life's journey and his approach to making a positive difference in his new novel titled Open Wounds. Good morning, Joseph. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing great, Johnny. Thank you very much for having me here.
Fantastic. I'm excited to have you on. Your book is very well written. The plot, your attention to details make it a wonderful and entertaining read. Congratulations. It's just a wonderful book.
Oh, thank you. I put a lot of work into it, a lot of years.
I could see that.
It's good to have it pay off.
I mean, I could see it. It just takes a lot of work to do what you did. And the fact that I knew that you did a lot of research and so forth to get this thing done. So that's just wonderful. Let us start by getting to know you a little better. Please give us a walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present moment.
Okay. This is always a hard question to start off with, especially when you think in terms of a whole life. But I'll make it brief then.
Okay.
I was born and raised mostly on Long Island in New York. And I guess I think of my life kind of as a short first part and then a relatively long second part. In the first part, I had my birth father was a very violent man. He had a mental illness and he was an alcoholic. So there was the first 3 or 4 years of my life were very challenging, let's just say. Mm-hmm. I have a brother and my mom, and she, along with help from my grandparents, got us out of that situation with my birth father because he just wasn't capable of really living with family, and it was just too much damage that he was doing. So we got away from him, and that's the first part. So the second part really happens when my stepfather, by the time I was 8, came into my life, and he's really been my real father since then, and I've been very fortunate to have someone like him as a parent in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And as a wonderful, I think, teacher of life. So along with my mom, they became my parents. I lived out in Syosset on Long Island. That's where I went to school. And then I went to CW Post, Long Island University, for my bachelor's degree. I started writing when I was in high school, but that's kind of been a through line. I think my life without writing is a very short space because everything that I've done since then really has had writing as kind of the backdrop and has fueled, I think, my writing. I spent some time in the United States Peace Corps. I was in Honduras during the Iran-Contra days back in the late 80s. It's really an interesting time to be a representative of the government, especially if you weren't very happy with Ronald Reagan, and I wasn't at the time. So it did give me a chance to go to places like the Mosquito Coast, which is just, if you think of adventure, I don't know, I hear the Mosquito Coast, and I'm like, wow. You know, I read the book, and I saw the movie with Harrison Ford, and I actually had a chance to go there. It was great. I didn't really want to stay there very long because it was kind of a scary place. It was in the middle of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
But it was really fascinating. And from Peace Corps, when I came back, I did public health work at organizations like Gay Men's Health Crisis. And today I'm working as the director of the Training Institute at a place called National Development Research Institute. And I specialize in doing drug prevention work, drug treatment work, work with folks who are providers who do work with folks who are HIV positive. I do a lot of leadership work, work on diversity skills and cultural issues. I train people in doing presentation skills, which is a long way from being a very shy child and then to regularly do conferences and be in front of groups of 400, 500, 1,000 people. I still can't quite believe that I'm the same person, right? I know that my teachers back in high school would just laugh at that kind of thing because I was a kid who hid behind the door as it was opened and held it for everybody else. And I'm like, where's Joe? He's still behind the door, you know? I'm married and have a 9-year-old son, both of which are really the joys of my life. My son is named Max, and or it's Karen. And I think kind of besides writing, another kind of overlay of my life has been different sports that I've played. I played rugby for 16 years in the Long Island and New York Metropolitan Rugby Union, and I fenced again since I was 18. and tried all kinds of other sports since then. I've also been a practitioner of yoga, and I've taught for the last 5 years in Jackson Heights in Queens, where I live right now. So that's kind of right up to now, which is my debut novel, Open Wounds, which was picked up last summer, and my life has really changed a lot since then.
Oh, I'm sure it has. That's wonderful news. Going back to the time when you were a teenager,
sure.
When did you discover you have a talent to write? I knew probably at that time you were sort of expressing yourself through journaling. So at what point in time were you realize that, hey, you know, what I'm writing is pretty good?
Well, I think I got to tell you, Johnny, as a writer, I have found this kind of a metronome as a writer. You know, one time it swings to one side and it says, yes, I have some talent. Then it goes to the other side and I wonder, do I have any talent? And kind of, I think the first time I realized I had some talent and had some urge to say, you know, I could do this mm-hmm. thing called writing, right? I entered an essay contest when I was 16. It was a contest, I don't remember exactly the subject matter was, mm-hmm. whether it was free writing or what, but it was something to do with, you know, some important event that happened in your life and write about it and how it mm-hmm. helps you to be who you are at 16. And so I wrote about, it was the first time I actually wrote about the death of a really, my best friend died when I was a couple of years before them, when I was 14. And he's mm-hmm. a kid that I basically spent every day of my life with up to that point. He had just kind of a freak accident. He left school one day and got hit. It was a very bad thunderstorm. He was hit by a train. I still don't know what happened to this day. I always mm-hmm. kind of question that. But it was a big, huge loss for me. And in some ways, I'm even talking about it now. I can still feel aspects of it. But 2 years later, I had this chance, and for some reason, I decided to write about that. And so I wrote about how reading fantasy novels, science fiction novels, helped me to cope and deal with it, and how writing about these things mm-hmm. and coming up with crazy worlds in games like Dungeons and Dragons and things like that, how they helped me to cope with his death. And I remember the teacher came up to me afterwards and she said, you know, she was one of the judges also, and there were, I guess, 600-700 people who had been in the contest, and she said, you know, you were one of the top six contestants, so we really couldn't give you one of the top three because your spelling was so bad. And this is, you know, this is before the days of computers, and this was all, you know, and so to that day I've been very grateful for spell check.
There you especially. Go
yeah very not much. That I'd be lost, but having that moment of her saying, you know, this is good, you know, you have talent here. And it had never occurred to me that I really had talent in this area. And from that moment on, I started the process of thinking of myself as a writer.
Do you find yourself spending a lot of time by yourself? Because writing is something that's very creative. So you're thinking, you're acting out all these things in your mind, and then it's a process of transferring that information to a piece of paper. So you find that, were you pretty much a sort of a loner kind of kid, getting one side and just start writing and journaling and so forth?
Oh, yeah. I spent a lot of time reading, so I was a very mm-hmm. big reader. So spending time with myself and by myself, those are, I think those are hallmarks of all writers. You can write in a community when you bring your work out, but I think for me, it's a lot of alone time. And up to mm-hmm. this day, that's something that can bother your partner and spouse and your kids.
Yeah.
Because you know, a complaint has always been, I think you're married to the computer. You know? It's like, well, if I got it right, I have to spend time on it. You know, and finding that balance has always been, I think, hard. And I think for most writers it is. But yeah, when I was a kid, I spent a lot of time by myself. So that was one of the ways to help me to, in some ways, disappear, but also to find, you know, other worlds and places to be stronger, to mm-hmm. to not be alone, and to survive. You know,
right. That's true. On the other hand, that's a wonderful man cave to have, though. I don't think the wife can complain about that.
Oh, I love that man cave thing. Yeah, I guess there could be a lot raunchier ones, right?
That's right. Yeah, so I would think that should work just fine. What was some of the inspiration behind your essays and poetry that has appeared basically in several print publications as well as online publications?
Yeah, I've been lucky to have a lot of short stories appear in you know, relatively small and then some more professional and larger magazines over the years. And I've had some essays published. Some more recent essays and Hunger Mountain online magazine was about open wounds and how I came up with one of the main one of the secondary characters who has a huge influence on the protagonist, on Winston Arnold Lifting Sham, right? And how I came up with him. So a lot of essay writing comes from the work that I'm doing, the writing that I'm doing. But others come from poetry, especially comes from fatherhood and being a dad. I had a piece called Dinosaurs about how I used to have all these little plastic dinosaurs in my pockets that I had published in Mothering Magazine, which I was really pleased with because I think it's just a great magazine for new parents and especially moms. And then I wrote a piece on 9/11 called Fallout. Mm-hmm. I was in the tower number 2 when they came down, and had that published in Chrysalis Review and had it up on my site on and off since then because this is the 10th year of that event. Still kind of reverberates. So those are kind of the places I've had essays, especially from articles that I've written. Usually I have friends or folks who've called me up who are editors and said, you know, we really like an article on absinthe. Could you write up something on us for it? And I said, sure. You know, because, Joe, you know all about drug prevention work and drug treatment. And I'm like, I can do it, you know, that kind of stuff.
Well, fantastic. But you also wrote, I mean, this is a guy thing now. You also wrote for Playboy.com. So tell us a little bit about that.
That always sticks out for people. I wish I could have this really glamorous story about doing a piece for Playboy. But really, it's not very glamorous. It's funny in its own way. I mean, I have a friend who was an editor at Playboy.com, and he had a whole bunch of summer pieces to do. So, like a good editor, he called up his friends and said, "Hey, do you want to do a piece for me?" And he said he was doing a whole big piece on summer reading, literary books that don't suck was the title of it.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "Can you read Lolita by Nabokov and you know, give me a book review?" So I had like 4 or 5 days. I read the book, and I wrote a book review, and I got a publication in Playboy.com. I also got to visit him at the site up in Third Avenue, Fifth Avenue, up in the 40s or 50s. So that was kind of fun. It's just an office, just a building, but it was nice that I went there.
So you didn't get a chance to go all the way out to the mansion, did you?
No, that would be crazy. I'd have stuff written about that if that was the case.
All you have to do is tell your wife, honey, I'm on the research.
Yes, I'm on research work here today.
That's
and
right.
There you go. It is funny what you end up, you know, doing as a writer, and then how things look and how myths grow. You know, and this is one of the myth making around me. I wrote a piece for Playboy.com. Yes, I did.
Right.
And it was, you know, it was fun.
There you go. That's wonderful. So, how did Open Wounds come about?
Open Wounds has a long history for me. It took me 7 years of writing and then another 2 or 3 years of marketing to actually have it come about. And I have to say, when I got the call from my agent that a publisher wanted to buy the book, I had almost given up on writing at that point, or at least selling a novel, because I've been writing for a long time and I'd marketed a number of books. Open Wounds is not the first novel I finished, but it's the first one to be published. And it's a long and rough road towards publication. You really have to kind of stay in there. And I was almost at the place where I was going to say, you know, blogging and writing articles, this is great, but the novel's just never going to happen. And then I got a call out of nowhere about it. So to me, it figures that the hardest book to write is the one that ends up being the first one published.
Right.
So this started with, I actually had an image, and a lot of my books and my writing comes from either experiences that I'm going through or images that I get, and they don't leave. And if it stays around with me for a month or so, I know it's probably going to be worthwhile writing about. And if it goes, then it's gone. So I saw, my wife had actually read a piece in the New York Times about the Chelsea Hotel, which is a very famous hotel in New York City, over on 23rd Street. Dylan Thomas drank himself to death there. That's what it's famous for, amongst other things. A lot of artists live there. And they said that there were houses on top and that there were some gardens and things up on top, and I'd never known that. And I remember I walked by there all the time as I would go to my job, because I worked in that area. And I remember looking up on top of the roof one day, just stopping and looking up, and I had this kind of vision of two men fencing, and they were fencing with sharp weapons. Mm-hmm. And it was a duel of some sort, and I could see one man's face very well, and he was in his 70s. He had a broken nose, and he had this incredibly sad look on his face. And the other man, I couldn't see because his back was to me, so he had to be in a righty. But I couldn't tell who the other man was. I just knew that this was a duel of some sort, and there was a reason for it. And this guy was maybe 72 or so. And then the image stayed with me for a week, a month, a year. And at the time, I had been taking classes at Herbert Burgruff Studios, HB Studios, and I was learning about stage combat and fencing, and I was doing a little bit of improvisational work and acting, and all of which I got involved with because of a writer's workshop where I had taken a writer's workshop where they said recommended, at that time, you know, reading your work out loud was the way to market your stuff. So they said that I took a workshop on reading out loud on acting technique, and they said you should go to HB Studios and they'll teach you technique and you'll get to be a better reader. So I went to HB Studios for acting technique, and I saw that they had a fencing class, and I'm like, fencing, stage combat, this is great. You know, I never knew there was such a thing other than watching movies all these years. And so I took that, and I really stayed for the fencing. I met a man named Joe Daly, who is just a wonderful actor, fencing teacher, acting teacher, all those things, and he really has been a mentor to me and allowed me to teach his classes over a period of time. But all these things kind of came together into this image of this man having this duel on top of the Hotel Chelsea. And what I did was I started writing about that time period, about him being 72 years old, and I wrote it in third person. I wrote 75, 100 pages of manuscript, and it wasn't working. So I started working my way back, and I traced his life backwards, finding all these key points. I made a big timeline, and until I got back to his birth and where he was born. And when I got to that place, something just spoke to me about that time period. So I put together about 400 or 500 pages of manuscript, and I had seen a couple. I've gone through a number of agents over the years, and I had one agent in particular who looked at it and said, you know, you should really make a choice with this book. You can either make it an epic story of 700, 800 pages and tell his whole life, or you can focus on his younger life. And I remember going back to my writer's group and throwing it around with them, and they were all very careful not to say one way or the other, but I definitely got a sense that half wanted to do the epic and half said I should have stayed, you know, with a younger emphasis. The younger emphasis just really spoke to me a lot more at that time. And I'm really glad I did, because I think it ended up to be a good book based on that kind of drive. But that's how I ended up writing the book, and that's how I ended up focusing on that time period. I worked my way back from 72 years old to birth and started and focused on that first part.
That's fantastic. Why did you choose a young adult theme?
Well, that kind of goes with the advice that this agent had said. He said, you know, you make it a young adult novel and focus on this. Yeah. Age area, but what's interesting to me is I didn't write the book to be a young adult novel per se. What I did was I wrote a story that had a young protagonist, and it's told through his eyes. And because of that, these days these stories are marketed to in that area as a young adult novel.
Right.
So it's always, it kind of makes me laugh in some ways, because I don't know that I consciously said I'm going to write it this way. Do you simplify words to make things more young adult? I don't think so. I think you write the way... I wrote the book the way it needed to be written. But what I really tried to do was capture the perspective of that age for this boy, of Sid Wyman. So in that way, that's why it ends up to be marketed as a young adult novel. But I know that adults can read it too and hopefully enjoy it.
Yeah. You certainly did. You captured that moment. I mean, it has high drama, adventure, love, compassion, all wrapped up in one, right versus wrong. When I read it, I mean, I'm looking at from a perspective of the Karate Kid, the gangs in New York, that kind of thing. Yeah. And when you're ready, the teacher will appear, and that kind of, you know, wanting to be the man that you want to be, you aspire to be. So all that wrapped up in a wonderful book. The book takes readers back, of course, to the 1930s and 40s in New York City. Why did you choose that time period in some ways? I know you walk backwards. And why the city?
Well, first, I love New York City, and I've just been fascinated since I was a kid, from the tall buildings to, you know, just the sense of how big it is. And I've done a lot of traveling for different works that I've done in the past, and you know, New York's just this huge place. And although there are lots of other big cities out there, I think, because I've grown up and I've had a chance to really explore some of the different neighborhoods and lived in different parts, obviously, it has this, I think, real rich history and attraction to me because of that.
Mm-hmm.
Sid's time period is that time period. So in some ways, the story chose a time period for me, but I know that I was very attracted to it because my father was, you know, basically the same age as Sid was. So he grew up in the same time period. My father-in-law also. And one of the things I did to write the book was I didn't set up to write a historical novel. I didn't know I could write a historical novel. Never written one before. But I found that doing the research, especially interviewing people who were alive then and who had experiences of the theater, mm-hmm. Of going to movies, of just, you know, walking down the street, what are the games that kids played? I just loved getting that stuff. So I interviewed my dad and my wife's father and mm-hmm. a number of other folks who were involved in these different areas. And it was just really wonderful to hear their stories. I love to hear people's stories of who they are and of their expertise in these different areas. And I found that absolutely fascinating, which is, I think, one of the reasons why I said this is why I want to write while he's in his 30s, in the 1930s or 40s, as opposed to the present day. It just really captured my imagination.
One of the things that I gather, there's a lot of things that you put in there. You're very, very detailed. So did your experiences as a fight choreographer, competitive pantser, and playwright help you in writing the book?
Oh, yeah. I have found that the things that I do end up in my books.
Mm-hmm.
So I had lots of different jobs. And my work in the theater, especially, it's been small, but I think very grassroots level. And in that way, I get to see things that that are really what a lot of acting is about and a lot of what, you know, plays are about. And it sounds funny, but not having a Broadway show or not working on that large scale means that, you know, the scale is very real. So, you know, Sid goes to see a play with Lefty. He takes mm-hmm. him to see Romeo and Juliet, and they're sitting, you know, exactly like it would be today with maybe mm-hmm. 20 seats. Most of the people in the theater are relatives or mm-hmm. friends of the actors on the stage, and there's a certain, you know, raw quality to what they see, and I think that was... These are things I was able to bring to the story, having experienced these things, you know, doing collaborative projects about a play and seeing what it means to bring a play to life, knowing a lot of the history of stage combat, and also just having a lot of the stories of that time period from mm-hmm. different people like Joe Daly, who just was a real wealth of information on, you know, what it was like to not only fence but to be in theater at that time, you know.
As an author, you're obviously writing and you're sort of, in a way, reporting as a third person. But then I sense that from what you have just told me and in reading what you've written, there's a sense of that directorship that kicks in as an underlying factor, you know, managing and developing various characters as you see the scene from a theater-like kind of a play. So how difficult was it in developing that?
I think that's it's really challenging to keep mm-hmm. Perspective. I mean, one of the things with first-person perspective, mm-hmm. and a lot of my work prior had not been first-person, a lot of third-person writing. So writing from the first person, you know, going back and then making sure what the main character sees is what has to be played out. And then, so that sense of directorship is very, I think, unique. It was fun to explore that in, mm-hmm. in a large book, but it's also, I mean, it's hard, you know, just trying to mm-hmm. keep all the characters and places moving. I mean, writing action scenes, especially, you know, and there's a lot of fencing in the book, so mm-hmm. Keeping people interested without driving them away with either the language or, you know, too much detail. It's like you read Moby Dick, and a lot of folks mm-hmm. don't mm-hmm. like the book because they couldn't get through the whale parts, you mm-hmm. know? Mm-hmm. So try not to have the white whale parts, but having only the interesting parts. You know, there's a famous writing advice, make sure you leave out the boring parts. I think it was Elmore Leonard who said that. It's hard, I think, as a director to get that balance. So one of the things I really tried to work for was that balance. I have to say, I think my work as in improv and in the acting classes that I went to and the theater work that I did was really helpful in getting that sense as a writer. You know, working in theater helps to be a better writer because it does give you that bigger perspective. You can look and examine, you know, the details of what's going on and then pull back and see the bigger picture. And I found that really helpful.
Very interesting. Open Wounds also speaks about social and economic issues of its time. Now, this is what I am getting out of it because each reader gets whatever they want to get out of it. But
sure.
That's what I'm getting out of it. How important is that for you?
I think both social and economic factors are very important. I've had people ask me, how relevant do you think a book, a historical novel about the 30s and 40s can be to today?
Yeah.
And I don't know, we're in the middle of a huge depression and recession. And these are, I think the issues are very relevant. I think what's fascinating is how, although people address the issues differently, there's also a tremendous amount of similarities, you know, from the loss of jobs and homes to the boarded up buildings, to the conflicts with police officers. I think also that just from a social perspective, one of the things that I found really interesting was, because I do a lot of work around diversity issues with the courts in my day job as the training institute director, I do a lot of work with drug courts in particular, which are alternatives to incarceration. In other words, instead of sending a young man who is maybe 20 years old into jail for possession of marijuana, you can send him to a treatment program. Because, you know, in a treatment program, he's not going to be turned into a criminal, but if you send him to jail, the odds are he'll be a recidivist for criminal behavior again. But what you see in drug courts, as is with many of them, is there are a disproportionate representation of Caucasians in drug court and not necessarily African Americans. They're not necessarily, but there are significantly more African Americans and Latinos, for example, in jail, in prison. So that disproportionate offering of services and or sending people into prison, these are all issues that I think are important and need to be worked on. I also do a lot of work around lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender folks in helping them. And I think that socially what I saw in the 30s and 40s were a lot of similarities with different groups. I mean, the same groups were being addressed, but in neighborhoods in Sunnyside, for example, in Queens, you know, you had Irish, Italians, and Germans, and you had a world war which was starting, and they were although the Irish weren't the enemies, the Germans and the Italians were. So how did that kind of play itself out? I remember my father telling me a story, because he has a German background in him, of being up on the roof of his house with a BB gun, and people would come to his door sometimes because they would yell at him, calling him a kraut. So, and then of course for those who are Japanese, all the issues that came around folks who were Japanese and here living in the United States and the discrimination that they underwent, and of course being Jewish, how that was. And Sid, the protagonist of the story, has to in a sense grow up and come of age, but also figure out who he is as a human being with regards to religion. What does he believe in? His mother was Jewish, so he's Jewish, but his father was Anglican, and his grandmother, who brings him up, is Anglican, and they didn't allow him to be anything else. They didn't want this taint, you know, of being Jewish to follow him. So he looks at being Jewish as something to get rid of. And then because of the friendships that he makes and because of the leadership he gets from this man, Lefty, he figures out that this is part of who he is too, and he starts that journey of trying to figure out what that means for him. What does it mean to be born a Jew in a place where you could call Jew boy, you know? So I think the differences in the cultural issues, even though they're still very similar, but these slight differences and the way that played out, it was also really interesting to me.
Yes, it is. And the other things that I got from the book as well is like the adoption, the fact that, of course, he was adopted by Lefty. And, of course, the fact that his dad was abusive, that's going on back then. That's real and even in today's world right now. And then, of course, the other side of the equation from a psychological side, of course, his dad taking things out on him simply because he's a reminder of the fact that his wife died giving birth to him. And those are real issues in some ways. I mean, we hear some of the horror stories that happen even now under those circumstances. So I thought you sort of introduced all those things in the book very nicely because it's sort of real life, real situation. Everything is believable.
Oh, I'm glad you think that. I have to say that one scene that you mentioned where the father tells him he's the reason that his mother died was, it's a very painful, I think, scene in the book to read, but it was really hard. It was very painful to write, even just to put down those kinds of words and and the kind of violence that the father does to Sid. You know, he takes a belt to him and just, you know, layers his back with cuts. And this is a kid, you know, he's only 7 or 8 years old, and then to tell him that. But this happens. It's very real. I mean, you know, these are the things that went on back then. Maybe people didn't talk about them as much in the 30s or 40s. That's what I hear a
precisely.
Lot of
people. Precisely.
They happened, but we kept this under the, you know, this is all hidden. And today it's much more out in the open. I think it's probably a better thing because if it's out in the open, it's less likely to happen, right? There's the shame over it. And there's, of course, consequences. So I think that that's probably a good thing. But the discussion of these things, I think, for young people especially, is going to be very valuable.
Right. Well, again, these are the things that are prevalent back then and are still happening right now. And like you mentioned, back then we don't have the internet. We don't have social media. So we don't hang out dirty laundries. How's that? And not that we do right now, but that's reality. So it's something that people can relate. I mean, as much history, you know, there's something nostalgic about talking about the past, but then in looking backwards, before we can look forward, we need to know where we came from.
Yeah.
So I think that's the beauty of the transition that you have done in terms of telling the story, because you can connect with present-day presence. I think that's the most important thing. So it's very unique from that perspective. How much of you is in the lead character, Sid?
Wow, how much of me? Yeah, there's a lot of me in Sid, but there's also a lot of Sid in Sid, and I wish there was more of Sid in me.
Well, that's always our alter ego now when we write about somebody else.
Yeah, so you got to make them in some ways like better, you know, stronger. I think that what I wish I had more of is really I was surprised at how much strength I put into this kid. You know, his ability to survive and his ability to be single-minded and just determined
focus.
To achieve what he wants to achieve and focus. And I have some of that in me, but not quite what Sid has. But, you know, it's funny. There was a writer, really a wonderful writer named Alan Barnett. He wrote a book called The Body and Its Dangers about gay men who were living in New York City during the, I think, late 80s and early 90s. And I was fortunate enough once at a conference to meet him, and we went for a long walk around this lake, and this is a very vivid memory for me, because he wrote realistic fiction. At the time, I wasn't writing much in the way of realistic fiction. I wrote a lot of fantasy and science fiction, a lot of maybe some horror stories. And I said, you know, I'm interested in writing more realistic fiction. And he said, you know, if you're going to do that, you're really going to have to go deeper into yourself. So I gave him a story that I wrote. It was the first real piece of realistic fiction I had written, and he said the same thing. Joe, you're going to have, this is fine, but you're going to have to go deeper into yourself. So I feel like with this book, I figured out what he meant, you know, that you have to find aspects, I have to find aspects of my life, things that occurred, and figure out how to translate that in an honest and realistic way into these characters. So, you know, the way Sid deals with loss, the pain of the loss of his family, of his friends, the not having a family, and then the getting of one, and then to lose it again, the violence that he goes through. I think there's a lot of commonalities through my existence, but I think I was able to translate them into this and create this character who for me really came alive. He was a kid and then a man, of course, so I couldn't get out of my head for years, and it's still there.
Do you find little pieces of Lefty and Nikolai, in your everyday life right now, you're obviously a counselor and you're an advocate.
As far as from myself?
Yeah.
Yeah, I have to say those two characters were the most fun to come up with. And I... Lefty is Vincent Arnulf Leftingsham, is Sid's cousin, who comes across from England to take him out of an orphanage. By the time he's 13, he doesn't know he has any family left. He's been told he doesn't, and then he finds out he does. And so Lefty is a veteran of the First World War, and he has no left leg, no left arm, no left side of his face. He's the victim of mustard gas, all kinds of PTSD. He's like half a man, you know, both physically, representationally, and just, I think, mentally. He's not all there, but he knew and really loved Sid's mother, so he becomes a real connection to Sid. But his character especially was a way for me to, I didn't think of this while I was writing it, but looking back on it now, I see aspects of father figures that I've had, of different men who have been in the role of a father or a mentor for me, I got Lefty to say and do things that these either was not said to me or was said to these different people in my life. And it's very cathartic in some ways to have that said, and to have a character who could say these things and be this powerful a figure. But of course, he's far from perfect. He's got a morphine habit to deal with the pain that he's in every day because of the mustard gas.
Yeah.
And you know, he's got violence streaking in himself. He's not the most social person, you could say, and he drinks, you know, to be able to deal with all the pain of the world that he saw from World War I and that he's carried with him since, the rejection that society really had of him as a veteran. Talk about connections to the world, you know, today. We're still treating veterans very much the same way, not understanding their experiences, you know, whether it's World War I or the wars that are going on right now and our vets are coming back from. And then, of course, Nikolai is this Russian fencing master, you know, who has his own ways of teaching, which are very strict. For him, he believes dueling is fencing. And dueling in a real sense is fencing, and so he teaches Sid to do it that way. But that's what he was taught. I think the two men together come together as one full human being. They provide discipline and they provide love. You know, they show Sid something that he has only had in fleeting glimpses throughout the first 15 years of his life. And they really show him that they care about him and that they love him. Even if they can't say it, they show it to him, and he has some recognition of this. And it's, I think, a surprise for him when he figures it out, too.
Very true. It's about survival. It's about right and wrong. It's about standing for what's good and standing for what you believe in. And that's the uniqueness of the storyline that you have mentioned. And also, what's interesting about it is that you give that wonderful glimpse of that's reality, and not to take people at face value or at their appearance, because there's a lot more within ourselves. A lot of times we get caught up in the situation, well, you know, it's what we see is what we expect. And so you don't expect these people to have something of value, internal value, to give up to somebody else. And I think that's interesting.
Yeah, I like books where characters are not so clear-cut. I like characters that they have these wonderful and lovely aspects about them, like Lefty, who can love Sid for who he is because he sees in himself this boy, right? And yet at the same time, he's almost incapable of showing this. And the same thing for Nikolai Varbrinsky, the fencing master. He is angry and gruff and violent because of what happened to him. He loses his family in Russia. He loses his daughters. He loses his wife. They're all killed. And so how do you recover from that, you know? Nothing is simple in life, and characters shouldn't be simple. And so I hope that I was able to bring this kind of complexity, and I think that's a very honest complexity to have in characters.
And you have, and again, even though it's set in the 30s and 40s, it's something that one can relate now, because those are really the ever-present social and economic challenges that transcends through time. so it's not anything new. It's the same issue.
Yeah, things stay the same in these certain basic human ways, you know?
Right. So that's the difference. What would you like to have your readers gain from reading Open Wounds?
I think that I would like them to have a sense of hope. I think a sense of adventure, too, because mm-hmm. Who doesn't like a good adventure, you know? There's mm-hmm. something about swordplay in the theater which speaks to that, at least for me. It always has. But I think that people, the sense of how we become whole, and that it can happen for anybody, regardless of how things are stacked against them, and not just through personal perseverance, which you have to have to some degree, but also because help comes, and sometimes in the most unlikely ways, you know, or from the most unlikely characters. When Lefty shows up, there's no way you think he's going to be a help in any way.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing with Nikolai Barbinsky. When Sid meets him, he throws up all over his hand, and he's drunk out of his mind.
Right, right.
How can these people end up to be helpful? But Sid, as by the time he meets Nikolai, he knows that this is someone who's been steered in his direction by Lefty because there's something to offer. He has something to offer him. And all of these elements help us to become whole. It's not just one thing. It is mm-hmm. a collection of a life, you know, that we pull together, or that gets pulled together for us, you know, by those around us who end up caring about us or loving us. And that's how you become whole. So I think that sounds kind of grand in the scheme of things, I guess. But I guess for me it's a real theme in writing. You know, how do we become whole and complete human beings? It's just not easy, but it can be done. And especially for young people who are going to read the book, I think that's an important message.
Where can someone go to buy your book, get more information about you, and keep up with your latest happenings?
Well, they can always go to my website, which is www.lunevicz.com. And there they can, if they like to go with an indie bookstore, use IndieBound or Amazon to pick up the book. It's available also at not a tremendous amount of bookstores, because it's a small press that mm-hmm. I'm working from. But a lot of independent bookstores have been carrying it, so I'm really pleased about that, too. And any bookstore that folks come to, even a local bookstore, they should be able to order it through their bookstore, so they can always give the business to the folks that they want.
Fantastic. How has this first novel impacted you personally?
Wow, it has changed my life. It's strange, but I said last summer, I had gotten a number of rejections on the manuscript, mm-hmm. and they were all good rejections, as we say in the writing business, you know, mm-hmm. with hope. The rejections that said, I really like this, but it's not quite right for our press, that kind of thing. And I felt like my agent kept, you know, moving from one to the next, and I was fortunate in that she stayed with it. And then she found, you know, so much of writing is finding the right fit. If you have a good story and it's well written, you still have to find the right publisher. So I was really fortunate. But I remember, yeah, I was in Maine on a camping trip with my wife and my son and some friends, and I got a call, and I couldn't believe it. I said, you're kidding me. And my agent said, Joe, because it was silent on the phone for a while. She goes, Joe, you can be happy now. I was like, but is it real? Is it true? So, you know, writing and having a novel published has been a dream of mine since I was very young. And, you know, when a dream comes true, it changes your life.
Right.
It's given me, you know, renewed hope. It's given me another pat in the back that says, yeah, you have a little bit of talent. There's something there, you know. As a typical writer, we always need those kinds of things, because it's easy to doubt in your time of being alone, sitting in front of a computer and waiting to hear from publishers. Mm-hmm. It's a hard aspect of being a writer. So when these things happen, I think they are really momentous, and in my life it has been. Including the amount of work that it is after a book is sold. There's a lot of work in selling a book. You can't just be a writer. You also have to market your work.
Right.
And that can be a challenge for a lot of folks. But I've always looked forward to it because of the work that I've done in my day job. I think that that's in some ways prepared me to be able to represent my work and talk about it with folks and to figure out what is a marketing plan, those kinds of things, you know. Which maybe a lot of writers don't want to do and get kind of pushed into. I've really enjoyed it so far.
How has your family taken this whole thing? And are you walking home now and making sure that your wife understands that, hey, by the way, you're addressing a published author now, so watch
it. She's going to get me later on when she listens to this. Yeah, well, they both are trying to make sure that my head doesn't get so big that it can't fit inside our apartment. That's always very important. You know, ego cannot get so big, right? I know that both of them are really proud of me. I know my son is, even though he's only read, I read him the first chapter of my book, but he's still too young, I think, for the book because of the language and the content. And he's the first one to say, I'm just not ready for this yet. so I look forward for when he's older and does read it. But my wife's been my biggest fan since I first started in this. Without her, there's no way I'd even have gotten the book finished, much less hung in there, you know, until I got the call from a publisher. So they're very supportive of my work as a writer. And, everybody needs their dreams. And I think as a family, we try to support each other's dreams coming true. So this is, they've been wonderful about everything, including keeping me with my head small enough to fit inside the front door.
Fantastic. What advice do you have for those who are aspiring to be authors?
Oh, it's really neat to get asked that question. It is. And it's good to be in a good place to answer it, you know, as opposed to saying, throw away your manuscript. Don't do it. It's too hard. perseverance is really important. Having faith in yourself and holding on to the knowledge that you have talent and believing in that, because nobody else is going to believe in you the way you need to believe in yourself as a writer. So that's of primary importance, and that kind of hanging in there. You know, so many writers write a book, but then don't keep marketing, don't keep at it, you know, don't write the next book because it's hard and you deal with a lot of rejection. So that kind of strength, kind of like this Sid Wyman's strength, you know, and seeing the target in front of you and saying nothing will stop me from getting there no matter how much I go through. I think that is a real help. And I think the other thing is, as Alan Barnett told me, you know, you have to go deep. If you want to write something that has the ring of truth, you know, to it, you got to go deep. And everyone has to figure out what that means. You know, my own path to figure that out is going to be different than someone else's. Some people find it very quickly. I'm one of those writers who has taken a long time to learn my lessons. You know, lots of work, lots of time. That's me. You know, other folks have taken different paths. So I guess that's what I'd say. Those are the two things.
Interesting. You mentioned just now that you speak about diversity issues, drug treatments, HIV, AIDS topics, and so forth. Why are these issues important to you?
I always wanted to, even when I was going through, when I was in college, and I got a business degree, mostly because I didn't think I could get a writing degree and that it would be useful to me, and I, of course, learned different afterwards, but I always thought to myself, I have to have a day job until something happens, and I still have a day job, but I said, if I'm going to have a day job, I want to do something that's worthwhile and important, and my time in the Peace Corps in Central America really helped me to see how I could, you know, be useful in the work that I do, how I could help other people doing work that would be useful to them and to, I think, society as a whole. And as a white man, you know, I have a certain amount of power and privilege in this world, and I can spend some of that by doing this kind of work. I can, you know, stand up, I can walk in the gay pride parade and not tell people whether I'm straight or gay, and just be one other person in support of a larger community or of a community that needs help. And I can do work, you know, I can stand up and talk to judges about why they need to examine eligibility criteria and why because African Americans aren't getting into their drug court programs. And I can say that, and it can be more powerful in some ways because of who I am saying something like that and addressing those issues. So I think knowing that has directed me kind of from one job to the next into these areas.
It's championing someone else's agenda in a way, but is the right thing to do.
Yeah, these are issues in our society that need to be addressed. And, you know, I think in some ways I address them in my writing, although I don't consciously think about it that way. I think it just comes out in the writing. But it, you know, the way I spend my time during the day, I think that it's all of our jobs in a way to do something that helps the world out in some way, shape, or form. And because of that, although I started doing work in retail and in the for-profit world, I quickly changed over because I saw that there was, I didn't know there was a nonprofit world. But when I came back from the Peace Corps, I realized, wow, there's this whole world. And, you know, you can make a living, but you can also do things that are important. So I changed jobs until I found the area in the field that I just felt most connected to and that seemed to make the most sense to me and that I felt like I could be the most helped in.
Okay. Wonderful. By the way, we're coming close to the end of the show. Do you have a recipe for a living would you like to share with all our listeners this morning?
Okay. Now, I did. I thought a lot about this. So there's a, I teach yoga, and there's a story I like to tell my students. It comes from it's an old Buddhist story, and I think it reflects a little bit on both the story of Sid Wyman and just myself and kind of my philosophy on life. So there's a woman. She's being chased by tigers. And she runs across a plain to the edge of a cliff. And she falls over the side of the cliff and hangs on to the roots of a bush. And so she's got tigers right above her, and they're just out of reach. And below her, she looks down, and she sees there's tigers below her. And the roots of the bush that she's holding onto are slowly starting to pull out. And she notices a mouse nibbling at the roots to help the roots fall out a little faster. She looks to the right of her, and she sees a small bush of strawberries. So what she does is she reaches out and eats the strawberries. And I guess the moral of the story is, you know, we're born and we die. We know these things. Tigers chasing us, tigers above, tigers below. And in between there's all these things, these hardships, these challenges, which will come up for us. And don't forget to eat the strawberries, because along the way there'll be plenty of them. Take your time, take them, and savor their taste.
Very interesting. That's wonderful. Just being present in the present moment.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Because that is what we have.
Because we can't worry about tomorrow, and we can't always dwell about the past, so we just have to be here in the present moment. Wonderful.
Yeah, and it's probably one of the hardest things to do in life, is to be present. You know, I think it gets made a joke of so much, you know, by popular culture, and yet there's this real deep truth to it.
Right.
Which folks have explored over the years and will continue to, because it is, I think, that important.
I think especially it's far more difficult for creative people, because we tend to think way ahead and we're not paying attention to what's at hand in so many ways.
Yeah, it is hard to be in the present when you're drifting in all the worlds inside your head. It is. All the more reason to come to ground. Right?
Yeah, yeah. And it's very difficult. By the way, you have done so much stuff. I mean, you have taught fencing. You have performed in improvisational comedies. As you mentioned, you are a practitioner and a teacher of yoga. So what's next on your agenda?
That's a good question. Usually what happens is I get involved in some activity, and that somehow translates into the next thing that I write about. I can't help but think that yoga has something to do with what I'll write about next.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, we have a couple of...
Oh, no problem.
No, so I think that there is an aspect of, you know, what yogis would call the inward journey, you know, the journey inside our minds, the journey inside to ourself with a capital S. I can't help but think that something that I write about, whether it's a young adult novel, whether it's a historical novel, or a novel for adults, it'll have something to do with that. It's been calling to me for about a year, and that's my mark to say that something is waiting, you know, to kind of emerge and to come out. So I think that's, it's not the, it's a vague response, but I think it's a direction of sorts.
Very interesting. You mentioned, of course, you want to stay within the same genre. Are you planning to still continue to write articles?
Yes. Whenever these kinds of things come up, I love to write essays. I blog and follow the folks' blogs. I find them, different types of writing are like exercising different muscles. So I'm hoping to get more chance to write about writing and to write about the process of writing more. And those opportunities, when they come, I'll be glad to take them.
Are you currently teaching anyone to write?
Nope. Although You never know. Maybe that'll happen someday. When I was a kid, I used to think, you know, here's the dream. You publish a book, and then someone will ask you to do a writer's workshop, or someone will ask you to teach writing somewhere. And who knows? Maybe that'll happen.
So that's not something that you're able to do at your work in some ways, because you're working with a lot of different people, and from a leadership perspective, teaching them to transfer their thought process on paper, so to speak.
Yes, and I've had the chance to teach. I mean, I am very much a teacher and an instructor in these different areas. I found that it's something that I have skill in, which is a nice thing to find out, you know, and to be able to use that in the day job, and then to be able to mix those two into the writing world, I think would be a nice combination. It would be wonderful.
That's great to know. Joseph, thank you for the great recipe for living you mentioned earlier, and for spending this hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. To all our listeners, thank you for being with us. Please join me next Tuesday morning. My guest will be curator, artist, and author Brian H. Peterson. His latest memoir is titled The Blossoming of the World, Essays and Images. Brian and I will be discussing about his life's work in creating an image of the wholeness experience that includes our objective perception of nature and our inner self. For additional information about this show, future shows, and to receive a free recipe for living, please go to FromMyMamasKitchen.com. Thank you for listening and have a great week. Joseph, thank you again and have a great day.
Thank you, Johnny.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.